From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, while President Bush toured Africa bestowing American goodwill, back home, the war in Iraq was generating some bad vibes. There's the fury of some military families over the mounting death toll in Iraq, the nagging questions about the ever-elusive weapons of mass destruction, the administration admission that there's no evidence that Saddam Hussein purchased uranium from Niger, and the official rewrite of the capture of Jessica Lynch. Thread by thread, the administration's tightly coordinated war message appears to be unraveling. Journalist and former presidential advisor David Gergen joins me now. David, welcome back to OTM.
It's good to talk to you again, Bob.
It seems that the White House is just sputtering. The swagger and the confidence seem to be gone. Is that your take? And if so, do you think that's going to have political consequences for the public at large?
I wouldn't go so far as to say the swagger is gone, but I would say that they're on the defensive. And I think unless they come to grips with this soon, it will have political consequences. I was surprised by the president this week while he was in Africa being fairly dismissive of the charge over Niger and whether the fabrication and what got into his speech on the State of the Union. Rather than being defensive, I would have counseled him to go on the offensive and to be angry about what happened within. Why in the dickens did anybody let him say that? I start with the position that the president himself thought it was true. And that Condi
Rice
thought
it was true.
Well,
that's one place to start.
Yeah.
There are other places to start.
Well, but if you assume that, then the natural response from somebody who's been misled by his own administration is to be angry.
Yeah.
And let some heads roll for how this information got into his speech and why he got put into this position.
Well, on this program, we have discussed a great deal how this White House has a level of discipline and coordination that we have rarely seen, maybe never seen in prior administrations in terms of message management.
They've been extraordinarily disciplined right from the get-go. There's a level of loyalty to the president, to the mission of the president, and to the message.
Well, at the risk of belaboring the obvious, what are the advantages of administration being so consistently on message from the very beginning?
Well, in first place, it creates a sense in the country that this is a very well-disciplined, organized, and sophisticated administration. The confidence level in the leadership goes up. But it also helps on the persuasion. You know, one of the critical goals for any president is not only to make a decision, but to persuade others to follow. And this administration, I think, has taken to heart the notion that if you can find a simple message and repeat it long enough, that people will give you permission to do what you want to do, even if they may not fully agree with you. I think most people who worked in past White Houses admire how much discipline they've had.
David, you're an inveterate advisor to presidents, Democrat and Republican.
Too many, probably.
Putting aside the particulars of this predicament, what would you counsel this president or any White House about the advisability of being so disciplined and being so on message if there's not absolute certainty that the simple, oft-repeated message is absolutely true?
I'm sure this administration will not want to hear this and think I'm crazy, but I happen to be a proponent for an administration that's much more open. There's a danger when you get administration that gets very closed and very buttoned up, and that is that you can begin to get groupthink within the administration. I went through Watergate with President Nixon, and I can tell you, we circled the wagons. There was a sense that everybody out there was out to get you, that the press in particular had pitchforks in their hands, they were coming over the barricades, and the only people you could trust were inside. And of course, then you begin talking to each other, and you don't even understand why people on the outside are angry. You don't get it. And we saw that in the Vietnam War, that the administration got very internalized. They weren't open to talking to critics. To a degree, the administration, which has been extraordinarily successful with this buttoned-up, disciplined approach so far, now finds itself trapped by some of its own rhetoric and by events that are spinning a little bit out of control. And I think that's why this past week they've stumbled some. They can't contain these State Department officers or people like Joseph Wilson, the ambassador, went to Niger and comes back and writes an article in the New York Times. They can't control it. I mean, that Joe Wilson was definitely off message. And they can't control the events on the ground in Iraq when people are, you know, popping up in urban areas and taking shots at our soldiers.
Certainly in the case of Vietnam and in the case of Watergate, the public was way behind the press in terms of getting frustrated with the administration and
yes,
its perceived responsiveness. And from the very beginning of the George W. Bush administration, the press has been pulling its hair out about the closed nature of the White House. Do you think the public is at this point catching on, or do you think that the president has more political capital and goodwill to burn?
This president has a lot more political capital and goodwill to burn. He's in very good shape politically still. He's on the commanding heights because we are on a war basis, war footing, and because people feel he has been, even if they have some questions about particular reports that he's used, they think Saddam was a terrible guy. But having said all of that, there is something now starting to eat away. There is not just Iraq and what was said before and what's happened since. There is also an argument starting to take shape that there have been many an occasion when the administration seemingly has said one thing and done another, that the rhetoric has not always matched the deed. And that is an issue. If the Democrats can pull that together, could be corrosive for the president unless the administration turned itself inside out to get all the facts out about what happened before we went into Iraq and to solve the problems that are popping up in Iraq itself. It's not sustainable to have every day or so a story about more Americans losing their lives in Iraq and next to it a story that we were misled about some element before the war started. Those two things coming together are not sustainable.
All right, I asked you what you would advise the White House. Now I'm going to ask you what you think the White House is going to do. Do you think it will revert to its old patterns of telling the same story again and again and again? Or do you think they're going to start to err on the side of more transparency?
I do not think they will move toward a lot of transparency without pressure or time. The new press secretary at the White House is very much in the same school of let's keep a buttoned-up discipline operation. Karl Rove, the chief strategist, is very much in that school. It's worked for them in the past. I think that they would rather ride out the storm than change the strategy.
All right. Well, David, as always, thanks very much.
Okay, take care.
David Gergen is a political analyst and former presidential advisor. He joined us by phone from Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Quagmire means a wet, boggy ground, yielding under the foot, a fen or a swamp. This week I entered the words quagmire and land into the Google search engine and found some 36,000 pairings. Then I Googled quagmire and Iraq and found nearly 37,000. Iraq is many things, but it's not wet, and yet, according to Google anyway, Iraq is the quagmire of the moment. Because in political speech, which is far more prevalent than geological speech, quagmire's principal meaning is metaphorical. It means the great sucking maw that was the Vietnam War. Here's Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld at a press conference earlier this month.
Now, the other part of your question.
Quagmire.
We have had several quagmires that weren't thus far. And I don't know, I didn't look that word up, I should have, knowing you. But why don't I think it is one? Well, I opened my remarks today about the United States of America. Were we in a quagmire for 8 years? I would think not. We were in a process. We were evolving from a monarchy into a democracy. If you call it what you want and then be held accountable for it.
Periodically on this program, we offer what we call a word watch, wherein we examine words that have popped up in the media. Tom Engelhardt is an author, editor, and creator of TomDispatch.com, in which he recently wrote at length on the word quagmire.
In a way, it reminds me very much of there was a style of movie when I was a kid in which an adventurer went out to some place like Africa, and there was always a scene where all of a sudden they stepped into some
quicksand
and began to go down. It's literally the idea that the land unexpectedly ambushes you. You didn't know it was there. You stepped into the wrong place. You're sucked down. It was obviously inadvertent. Quagmire was one of the images that one of the few images really that made it out of the war and just lodged, particularly in the military and political mind of America. It was one of the lessons to be avoided. You know, Colin Powell, when he was still Joint Chief of Staff, his so-called doctrine was we were always to have an exit strategy. And that exit strategy was a version of not quagmire.
One of the most interesting points that you make in your recent Tom Dispatch is that actually our understanding of quagmire as applied to Vietnam makes a lot of assumptions that when examined are actually wrong, because quagmire suggests that you can't get out. And you say, well, that really isn't what happened in Vietnam.
It's a very strange term for this war that we embarked on and continually planned for at the highest levels. There was quite careful ratcheting up of military power and so on and so forth. It was not, in the normal sense, a quagmire.
Even though it was long and drawn out and agonizing, it was nevertheless the intention of the government all along. Therefore, no quagmire.
Yes. I mean, the thing about war words generally is that they're often not so much a description of a war as a worldview imposed on a war, and this certainly was, in the sense that the one thing that quagmire does is, first of all, it turns the land of Vietnam into the agent, the enemy, and it turned us into a helpless victims. I mean, somehow we had ended up there through good intentions, we put our feet down, and the land began to suck us in, and we never somehow could withdraw. So in a way, the image took away agency.
So if the quintessential political quagmire, Vietnam, wasn't really a quagmire, is then Iraq?
I think what's interesting is that maybe it's even a more accurate image for Iraq than it was for Vietnam. The quagmire as an image is locked inside the brains of American military and political leaders. And so for them, I think they are experiencing it as a kind of quagmire because even though they planned to go into Iraq and stay for quite a while, they did not actually imagine the situation that's come about. If this word takes hold in America, it's a quagmire for our leaders. They could well be sucked down right here by that term and everything that goes with it.
Tom, thank you very much.
You're most welcome.
Tom Engelhardt is a fellow at the Nation Institute and author of The End of Victory Culture, A History of American Triumphalism in the Cold War Era.
Well, I'm not going to point anymore. I'll leave that for yourself. Maybe you're still walking, you're still talking, you'd like to keep your health. But every time I read the paper, them old feelings come on. We're waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. Waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on. Waist deep, neck deep, soon even a tall man will be over his head. We're waist deep in the big muddy, the big fool says to push on.
Coming up, how Howard Dean trumped the media, democracy delivered online, and a dangerous dissertation.
This is On the Media from NPR.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The first Democratic primaries of the presidential race are still more than 6 months away, but already there's a standout, at least in the media. According to a search of the Nexus database over the past 3 weeks, more stories mentioned Howard Dean than any of the other Democratic candidates. So what's all the buzz about? Are the media simply following the money, since April Dean has raised more cash than any other Democrat in the race? Or is it that Dean has tapped a passionate vein in the electorate? He did score an overwhelming victory in the recent straw poll by the political website MoveOn.org. Writer William Powers wrote about the media's sudden interest in Howard Dean in this week's National Journal and joins me to discuss it. Bill, welcome back to OTM.
Thank you.
First of all, judging from the general tone of the recent coverage, the reaction to Dean's campaign among many journalists has been one of surprise. After all, this was a guy whose name recognition last fall fell below the category of other on some polls. Mm-hmm. But even then, you wrote very presciently that there were several reasons why nobody should write Dean off yet.
Yes, I said that in November, mainly because I know him a little better than most journalists do. We've been doing a TV show together on Canadian TV that also runs on PBS for years. I just feel that he's one of these fellows who, one, has figured out what works with the media. He's figured out this sort of authenticity that John McCain had, how to be, in a way, self-consciously unself-conscious.
And in the months since November, that's played out. But as prescient as your November piece was, you never anticipated that money raising would put him in the limelight.
No, I absolutely didn't. In fact, I thought back when I wrote that in November that the media attention I figured he'd eventually get would be enough. But in fact, what it took was, we've just seen in the last few weeks, it took basically $7 million. I mean, that's the amount he raised in the last quarter when candidates had to report their fundraising. He raised a lot of it at the last minute through the internet. And finally, now that he's shown he can raise money, he's really taken seriously. He's gone to a whole new level. And it's shown me how much we in the media really buy into this notion that fundraising is what matters most with a presidential candidate.
But, Bill, doesn't this all fall into the category of it's so crazy, it just might work? I mean, Dean got it all wrong. You're supposed to get the media first and then get the money. He got the money first and sidestepped the media pundits altogether.
Although, Brooke, if you look back at the coverage of him, there's always been a little strain playing, a very sympathetic coverage and interest in Dean. I mean, there was always this intrigue about this doctor from Vermont, which is this very iconoclastic state. You never know what you're going to get from Vermont and so forth. He's got an unusual story that we always tuned into. And now I see what was missing. What was missing was he wasn't really a player in our eyes, the media's eyes, until he had the money.
What about Dean's personal relationship with the press? It seems that he doesn't go out of his way to cozy up to the media, and many have commented on, I guess, what you'd call his churlishness with journalists. Do you think his tone is a liability with media insiders, but a net plus with the electorate at large?
I think that's a very good reading of it. He's got this New England reserve. He's not a instantly warm figure that's trying to ingratiate himself with you in a way that John McCain is. But this other side of him, this kind of unvarnished, speak my mind, you know, I'll be damned if I don't say what I really think feeling, plays really well on TV and plays really well with the masses, I think. And that's sort of what's developed this following that he's got.
A lot has been made of Dean's appearance last month on Meet the Press. One Daily News columnist called it, and I have the quote here, perhaps the worst performance by a presidential candidate in the history of television. And other reviews were only slightly better. Let me ask you first, you were there identifying when John Edwards tanked on the Sunday gas bag programs, as they're called. How bad do you think Dean really was?
Well, it wasn't his strongest moment for sure, but I also think he wasn't quite in the Edwards category. I mean, I don't think he flamed out in that appearance. And interestingly, you know, much of the money he raised in this latest quarter that's made such a big splash came after that appearance on the Russert Show. I think Howard Dean had a lot of these people teed up to give money to begin with through a lot of this attention he's gotten through Move On and some of these other efforts. And when he really pushed it, they were ready to go, and many of them probably hadn't even seen that show. I mean, this internet fundraising trick he's pulled off is historic in many ways, according to what I've read.
So you think Salon was right when it referred to Dean as the presidential candidate from the great state of Blogland?
In some ways, although Dean himself, you know, is not super plugged into that world. It's not as if he came out of that world. It just seems that those people in that world have taken to him. And he's clearly gone mainstream as a result of that extra push.
People always say that the internet represents a democratizing force in American discourse. So I guess the question is, will the internet enable candidates to sidestep the mainstream media and reach the people more directly than in previous elections when candidates have tried to do that and failed?
It may. I mean, what I find interesting, Brooke, and a little bit disheartening, is that, you know, the internet's been around for a while now, and it sort of didn't matter until it became a money question, until Dean figured out how to raise cash through this medium. was it finally given this legitimacy? And I wrote this week that it's just a little bit surprising that that's what it took. It's as if it's, you know, it's a new medium, but same old, same old. What matters ultimately is the bottom line.
Bill, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
William Powers is a writer for the National Journal, and he spoke to us from member station WCAI on Cape Cod.
Imagine, if you will, helping to make laws and craft regulations on the Internet. Right now, we can trade anything through eBay, learn everything from Google. Why shouldn't we have the capacity to order up political reform online? On the Media's Susan Kaplan reports on the latest digital leap forward, e-democracy.
The idea of using the Internet to involve people in politics, sometimes called e-government, is not new. Unless, of course, we remember that the World Wide Web is only a little more than a decade old.
When the Internet bubble was really going, and there was a lot of investment out there, tons of companies emerged to do this kind of work, to help connect people with governments.
Colin Rule, one of the founders of Mediate.com, an online dispute resolution provider, says when money for Internet startups dried up, most of the investment in e-government projects did too. But he believes the Internet will evolve into a new arena for civic participation. He thinks an increasingly tech-savvy population will drive the demand. And he doesn't believe the general public is apathetic or uninterested in politics.
I think that one of the reasons why people don't participate is because they just feel completely disconnected from the process. There's no avenues for participation. There's no sense that their input matters. You may have a vote, but that's a very blunt instrument for expressing your opinion.
Rule, who also teaches an e-democracy course at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst, says part of the Internet's promise is that it lets people hash out their thoughts on a particular subject, the chat room concept. He says it's through this sort of conversation, or what you might call virtual public debate, that people come to understand their political positions and develop their political identities. But he says it all depends on accurate information. He says before the Internet, governments held most of the power over information, something he says the Internet is helping to change.
I mean, the government has put billions of dollars into building systems that allow the citizenry to get access to that information. And those websites like FirstGov or eGov or regulations.gov, they're websites that the federal government as a whole has put together to aid that information dissemination process.
But Rule says dissemination without the mechanism for deliberation isn't going to engage people. In other words, there has to be a way for the decision-making process to be interactive. He says that's taking more time to put into place, and in some places, it's already happening.
Public participation has taken root more firmly in Europe and in Australia and in Southeast Asia than in the United States in some arenas. There are treaties that have been adopted by the EU, for instance, dealing with public participation and environmental decision-making that require these type of online multi-party dialogues to occur before a policy is enacted.
There are examples where the Internet is already having an impact on public policy. Recent events, like when the FCC was forced to respond to the public in part through an Internet campaign, or the huge amount of money raised online by presidential candidate Howard Dean. But the Internet's value as a tool of democracy is only as good as the democracy itself. Shanti Kalatul of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace is author of Open Networks, Closed Regimes: The Impact of the Internet on Authoritarian Rule.
One of the common fallacies that usually exist when people talk about the Internet and democratization is the assumption that the Internet itself will lead to democratization. And in fact, you know, the Internet is simply a tool, and if there are obstacles to democracy, it can't necessarily rout around those political obstacles.
To try to get a better handle on evolving e-government in the U.S., UMass professor Colin Rule assigned his students the task of finding concrete examples of e-democracy. And what they found, like democracy itself, was a little messy.
Oily Clams is unregistered. Peeper's unregistered. Taxpayer 2 is unregistered. Hit the Nail on the Head is unregistered.
That's James Perry, listing some of the aliases of unregistered users of a website in his hometown, Westport, Massachusetts. The site, run by a local newspaper, is a forum for discussions about local issues like town zoning and select board policymaking.
A ton of people look at this stuff. My father's the one that showed me the website when my uncle was bad-mouthed on it. And my mother and my father and my brothers, aunts, uncles, grandparents, They're all on it, and they're all reading every night.
Harry says even though the website often becomes a kind of online rumor mill, it also seems to make the local politicians a bit more careful about what they say and do.
There's a lot of activity on this site, and that's good to see. There's a lot of gossip on this site, and that's not so great to see. But, you know, a lot of it's true, and that makes things interesting because sometimes people try and get away with stuff, and they don't. There's always someone looking.
Websites like those in Westport reflect the Democratic staple of holding public officials accountable. Web guru Esther Dyson, who publishes an online journal, says the net is a great way of getting information out there so people can make informed political decisions.
But it's not a great place to build social culture. It's not where children learn to share and to take turns. It's not where adults learn to compromise and do deals and negotiate tough issues. It's great for spreading news. But it, again, human beings are still chemical, not digital, and you can't forget that.
It's also important not to forget, even with all its reach, power, and impact, the Internet is, anthropologically speaking, only recently out of the primordial soup. Again, Colin Rule.
I think the strategies that people are using, the innovation that's happening now, is just the scratches on cave walls stage. Eventually, we're going to get to the printing press and move it forward, and I think whether or not it's going to take 2 or 3 years, like everybody originally thought when the Internet bubble was growing strong, or whether it's going to take 10 years or 15 years, the end result, which is the efficient integration of technology and its use to improve the operation of democracy, is almost a foregone conclusion.
For On the Media, I'm Susan Kaplan.
A George Mason University grad student was just hoping for a doctorate and a job. Instead, his PhD dissertation is being called a terrorist treasure map and scaring the bejesus out of the gatekeepers of America's communications infrastructure. That's because his project maps the nation's entire fiber optic network, overlaying every business and industrial sector in America. The question is, should the map be public information like any other academic research or placed under lock and key? Steve Aftergood directs the Federation of American Scientists Project on Government Secrecy, and he joins me now from Washington, D.C. Steve, welcome back to OTM.
Thank you.
So what can this map do? According to the Washington Post, I'm quoting here, he can click on a bank in Manhattan and see who has communication lines running into it and where. He can zoom in on Baltimore and find the choke point for trucking warehouses. Has he indeed created a roadmap of the nation's communications vulnerabilities that had never existed before?
I doubt it. He himself says that what he did was to compile information that was already in the public domain.
But if you were a terrorist and you were looking to wreak havoc, it would be like one of those mall maps, you can bomb here.
I don't think it's the right way to look at things. If one were a terrorist, one would not require a PhD dissertation on this subject or any other in order to locate a vulnerability. There are vulnerabilities all around us. And the idea that if not for this or that piece of information, we could be perfectly secure is an illusion.
Gorman said that government officials and private sector CEOs want his work to be classified by the government. Can it be classified?
Strictly speaking, it cannot be. That applies only to government information. The only situation in which the government can seize privately generated information is when that information concerns nuclear weapons. If I conceive of a design for a nuclear weapon and write it down on a napkin, the government can claim ownership of the napkin and come in and seize it.
Richard Clark, the former White House cyber terrorism chief, told Gorman he should turn his dissertation in for a grade and then burn it. Well, apart from a voluntary immolation, what do you expect will happen next with this particular piece of research?
I am a big believer in people taking responsibility for their own work. Nobody knows this work better than Mr. Gorman, the author. And if he is persuaded that there is a real national security concern here, he should act accordingly. And I gather that that is the course of action he has chosen. He is not releasing the work. It is apparently being kept in secure storage. I presume that's the right thing to do.
I guess I'm asking you, if can you imagine a circumstance where you would change your stripes on this subject, where you would say, well, you know what, at some point the government does have not only the right but the responsibility to step in to suppress otherwise public information?
I think that the answer is clearly yes. What's an example? Detailed information on the production and manufacture of biological weapons. Now, I would hate for an admission like that to be turned into an indiscriminate new power of the government to control information. The desire for security is a natural, normal, and an important one. But the desire for absolute security is neurotic. It's neurotic because it is not achievable and because it leads to a self-defeating posture. You end up tying your own hands, diverting resources where they are not productively used, and you can never really solve the problem.
Now, there's another wrinkle in this, and that is not government oversight, but scientific oversight.
Earlier this year, a number of the largest scientific journal publishers issued a statement that from here on out, they are going to consider security, the hazards of publication, when they review scientific papers for publication in their journals. Last year, for example, a group of scientists published a paper on the production of a synthetic polio virus. But the fact of the matter is there is no great solution to this challenge. The science of biological weapons is largely indistinguishable from many areas of life sciences, medical research, and so on. And you cannot restrict one without restricting the other.
All right, Steve. Well, once again, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Steve Aftergood directs the Federation of American Scientists Project on Government Secrecy. His newsletter is called Secrecy News.
Coming up, cartooning, both naughty and nice, and taking revenge on telemarketers.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities, on the web at www.wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
We are back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. When the Federal Trade Commission's Do Not Call list went online late last month, the telephone answering public rushed in. By early this week, more than 23 million frustrated telemarketees had signed on to be left alone. And that's one way to deal with the annoyance of unwanted sales calls. Another way is Tom Mabe's guerrilla approach. As Bob learned in a conversation from a couple of summers back, Mabe has recorded and released his efforts to torture telemarketers telephonically.
We're a nonprofit organization, and we're calling you today in hopes that you'd be willing to help someone less fortunate than yourself.
You just hit my heart. You know, I do so much charity work. I pay the conjugal visits down at the prison. Don't get me wrong, some of these guys just need to be held.
Tom Mabe, I guess the question that all of America is asking is, what the hell is the matter with you?
I got tired of MCI calling me more than my friends and family did. You know, I'm financially embarrassed waiting for the phone to ring, you know, being a musician and working out of the house. And it kind of said, heck, I just, you know, I'm like, I like having fun. I just started, I had my little $37 answer machine. I hit the memo button and started recording.
What's your favorite one?
Low self-esteem, the first cut, is kind of like my Sweet Home Alabama. Everybody knows me by that cut. You know, hey, yeah, that's the kind of the hit off the CD.
Hello.
Is this Mr. Mabe?
Yes, sir.
This is Cheryl calling on behalf of A-Card.
Tell you what, ma'am, I just got a call from my boy's school. His school counselor called up and said that he had low self-esteem and he needed more encouragement at home. I tell you what, I try to encourage him all the time to be half as good as his brother. But go ahead.
Okay, sir. The reason for my call... As a valued card member, in the next 2 to 3 weeks, you will be receiving a 30-day no-risk trial of...
30-day no-risk trial? Well, I wish the hell I had that kind of guarantee on my boy.
Is he sitting right there with you?
He's right next. Sit down there, quit your crying, and be quiet.
Sir, maybe he needs a little more encouragement.
I tell you, encouragement. I encourage him all the time to be half as good as his brother.
Well, sir, I am a mother of three, and...
Your mother of three?
The way you are talking to him is not very encouraging.
Why does this strike such a chord, such a resonant chord with listeners?
Well, because right now when people are listening to us, there's a lot of them being interrupted by telemarketers. I mean, trying to feed the baby, trying to have dinner. I mean, geez, they call the most inappropriate times.
Was there a single moment of inspiration that you're most proud of, that you feel like God touched you?
Yes. First CD. It's called Tom Fires a Telemarketer.
Before we continue, I need to tell you that our supervisors periodically monitor these interviews to ensure quality and courtesy. Do you currently have a paid job?
Oh, yeah.
And are
I'm a porn star.
That's funny. I'm surprised I haven't met up with you because I'm a porn star, too.
Are you really?
Yeah.
What movies have you appeared in?
All of them.
All right, then.
Okay.
Church Kendi speaking. May I help you?
Hi, this is Dr. Thomas Mabe. I'm trying to get a hold of an employee of yours, Teresa Murphy.
Oh, hi. She won't be in till 1 o'clock.
Okay.
Doctor, do you have her home number?
No, I do not have it on me. That's why I'm calling her work.
Okay, so I can give it to you.
Okay, thank you so much.
Okay, so let's hold on 1 second. Here we go. Okay. And her number is 563.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Katie.
Sure. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Teresa?
Yeah?
Teresa, this is Tom Wrightson. I'm calling for Research Corporation.
Yeah?
I work in a quality control department. We had monitored a call that you had a couple weeks ago where you were claiming to be in the porn industry, and the company has a problem with that because the name is representing you with the porn industry. We can't have that.
I don't remember saying that.
Well, we have it on tape, and unfortunately, we're going to have to... We're going to ask you not to come into work and we'll mail you your check.
My God. You're serious, aren't you?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Okay, bye.
Then I had to call her back and say, hey, just a prank.
Tom Mabe of Revenge on the Telemarketer fame. Next month, he takes the pranks even further on his new album, in which he follows telemarketers to a convention and calls them in their hotel rooms in the wee small hours of the morning. Twenty-five years ago, two gigantic forces were unleashed on the unsuspecting world of daily newspapers. The first was Garfield, whose storied career has touched literally dozens of readers from coast to coast.
Mm. And then there was Garfield the Cat, whose eponymous cartoon strip is in more than 2,600 papers worldwide, and whose image is the basis of a multi-hundred-million-dollar-a-year cottage industry. Joining us now from Muncie, Indiana, is the creator of Garfield the Cat, cartoonist Jim Davis. Jim, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Bob.
Well, first of all, I want to thank you for ruining my life.
I knew that was coming.
Garfield like the cat. Do you like lasagna? Yeah, damn you, Jim Davis. So apart from that, 25 years, congratulations.
Thank you.
Your character, Garfield the Cat, is fat, lazy, and aloof. If he were a person, he would have no friends. What's the appeal?
We see ourselves in Garfield. And for some reason, because he is a cat, it's endearing. In fact, that's the reason I wanted to work with an animal. I'd worked for 9 years on the Tumbleweeds comic strip as assistant to T.K. Ryan. And he got grief. He had cowboys and Indians. And whatever he did, he got grief. There was a sit-in at Wounded Knee many, many years ago. He lost 6 papers over that, in spite of the fact that he treated the Indians with more dignity than he did the cowboys. And I learned early on that people take their cartoons very seriously. So I knew if I did an animal, he would have a lot more latitude with the humor.
Well, on the subject of fat, lazy, and aloof, 365 days a year for 25 years. That's like 9,000 days of telling basically the same joke.
Mm-hmm.
Do you ever want to just chuck it and say, no, you know, I love Garfield, but I just don't want to tell the same joke for the 9,001st time?
I'm still trying to get it right. So that keeps me going. It really is. It's the novelty is never worn off because I get to change hats a lot, too. I do the comic strip. We work some with TV. We work with a movie. We work with Garfield in plush and apparel and publishing and things like that. And I'm constantly learning more about the character, polishing other facets of his personality. He's easier to work with, and in other ways, he's more challenging to work with today than he was 25 years ago.
Well, he is a good character, and he is amusing. But I don't think I'm going to offend you when I say this. He's almost never hilarious.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the strip is a little thin on plot. He's not, as you alluded to, because he is so intentionally non-controversial. He's not exactly exploring the frontiers of comic strip writing the way Al Capp did with Lil Abner or Charles Schulz did with Peanuts or Gary Trudeau has done with Doonesbury. Where do you place Garfield the Cat in the pantheon of the genre?
I can take parts of him and play some with other cartoons, I guess. Mort Walker, Beetle Bailey fame, refers to both of us as Bigfoot cartoonists. So we do characters of big feet, big hands, big expressions. I change the humor up a little bit each day. Some days I do a physical gag. Some days I do a nice thought gag, a smiler. So every day when they open the newspaper, they don't know exactly what to expect of Garfield, except he's still going to, like you say, he's going to be lazy, he's going to be fat. But you know what? It says that there are some things you can count on day in and day out. You can always go back and see Snoopy on his doghouse. Now, in that respect, I do relate Garfield to Snoopy in that the lines are very simple, the humor is elegant, and it deals with interpersonal relationships. Once you are not laughing at the strip so much because of the humor, but because you're saying, isn't that true, then the strip has some meaning to you. Then you're going to be following it for 25 years.
Jim, as I look over my left shoulder, I have a plush Garfield around the neck of which I have fashioned a noose because he has so bedeviled me for 25 years. You know, at this stage in my career, Jim, I had hoped to sell calendars and coffee mugs with my image on them, but I guess that's out of the question. Do you ever, you know, wish to strangle the little so-and-so?
Not really, in that he's the famous one. He takes a lot of heat off me. But we have about 50 people on staff who support the licensing program, deal with the international companies. We have a motto: if we take care of the cat will take care of us. So more power to him. You know, he's made a very nice living for a lot of families in East Central Indiana. And so I hope he goes on for a long time.
Jim, thanks very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Jim Davis is the creator of the 25-year-old Garfield the Cat.
In Britain's Guardian newspaper, legendary political cartoonist Steve Bell wields his ink. Bell regularly delights his readers by being brutal beyond the boundaries of taste that prevail in the American press. Recently, he crossed the pond to attend a convention of the Association of American Editorial Cartoonists in Pittsburgh. He wrote in The Guardian that he was more impressed with the splendor of the gathering than the American tune's political punch. He says that even an exhibit of cartoons that had been spiked as too hot to print were relatively weak tea. We called on Bell in Brighton for more on political cartooning here and in Britain.
The main difference is that over in your side, everybody's drawing locally based stuff. All the papers in the States are more or less local papers. There aren't really any real national papers, unless you count the New York Times or USA Today.
And the New York Times significantly doesn't have its own cartoonists.
No, that is another great failing, I would say. I think the difference over here is this, because it's a national press, generally all the papers are based in London, each paper tends to have a sort of political line.
So how would you describe your style, artistically and editorially?
My style is probably certainly a lot less wordy. I deliberately avoid the use of labels in my work. The thing is, I mean, when you're in the context of a newspaper is actually a mass of words. There's no getting away from it. You have to assume that people have actually read the words, so I cannot see the point of repeating by pasting a sort of notice on somebody's chest what they represent. I think the symbolism should be implicit in the image. The other thing, I think I can probably get away with certain physical rudeness.
I would love an example of that.
Well, it's more to do with, I suppose, drawing people's butts, as you would say. This stuff. I can get away with sort of body parts and things like that. Also a certain rudeness in the use of language.
Now, you noted that when you went to the exhibition here of spiked cartoons, you were surprised by their relative editorial mildness. What's your most recent cartoon that actually got you into trouble? Or have you never gotten into trouble?
Oh, no, I've gotten into trouble quite frequently. It's usually on grounds of either libel or good taste, decency. You want me to describe it?
Yes, I do.
Well, the most recent one was, how can I describe it? It was George W. Bush in the bathroom, you say, but we say crapper.
Mm-hmm.
And his place is covered in, well, what can I say except crap? Terrible mess, and this is a symbolic mess, and he's reaching for the toilet paper, which is in the shape of the United Nations flag. Now, that one I had to reduce the number of, shall we say, turds on the wall. That's my most recent example of censorship. So, I mean, I took three of them out, and that was fine. They printed it.
You note that the political cartoons in newspapers actually float in a wave of words. Do you think that cartoons should take risks that stories don't?
Oh, definitely. I think cartoons can do things and should do things and are capable of doing things that words can't do. And they shouldn't turn their noses up at the opportunity to do it. You cannot make your cartoons acceptable to everybody. Somebody's always going to disagree with it, and that's part of the problem. So the problem I see with American cartoons is because they're in the often in local papers dealing with the local, and they're the monopoly paper for that area, they're feeling they have to deal with all shades of opinion and appeal to all shades of opinion, and that's difficult. In fact, that's almost impossible to do.
In fact, you conclude that the role of the cartoonist is to outrage the outrageous.
What's the point otherwise? You can't have a cartoon that everybody agrees with, otherwise it wouldn't be a cartoon and it wouldn't be worth looking at anyway. It's bound to outrage, and especially in a situation where things are polarized, as they are now, you're going to be finding you're putting people's noses out of joint all the time, and it's going to happen. And American cartoonists know this damn well because they're dealing with it all the time.
Since we're in America, not likely to see The Guardian before it comes out, what are you working on now?
Well, I've just done one. It's again to Tony Blair, and it's talking about this business about him being exposed as a lying warmonger, basically. So it's more to do with him being hung out to dry. So I have had him literally being hung out to dry by his ears. I don't know why. Sometimes I can't explain it or justify it. It's something I can't shake off. An image will come to mind, and I just can't shake it off, and so I have to go with it. it might sound haphazard and crude, but I think often it works better that way if the image leads it. But there's a rationale behind it that has to have a bit of a kick to it.
So if you, a legendary cartoonist, suggest that people don't draw from their heads but actually draw from their spleens, that's the way to go.
Well, I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that entirely. I think you have to do both. It's, shall we say, it's a delicate synthesis between abuse and reasoned argument. We all have our points of view we want to put across. But, you know, there's a thing. You really want to get people with it as well. That's the point. You do. It's an attacking medium. There's no point pretending it isn't.
Steve Bell, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you.
Steve Bell is an editorial cartoonist. His story, A Hard Line on Bush, ran in The Guardian, and he joined us on the phone from Brighton. This week, a judge in Modesto, California, ruled that prosecutors may listen to wiretaps of calls made to murder suspect Scott Peterson earlier this year. Many of these were calls placed by reporters who apparently stopped at nothing to bag that big interview. In fact, the investigator who tapped the calls told the Associated Press that, quote, "I've listened to as many of the media calls as I could stomach," adding that if he were among the reporters caught on those wiretaps, I'd be fighting tooth and nail to keep them under protective order. Well, On the Media has no shame. As you'll hear from our own wiretap, we kept our dignity.
Hey, Scott. Bob Garfield from On the Media. Look, I know you're probably getting a lot of calls, but we really think you ought to consider coming on to OTM. First of all, we believe that you've just been crucified in the press, like Richard Jewell or Jesus. Also, if you did happen to murder your wife and unborn child, does anyone ask for your side of the story?
Bob Garfield here. I just got cut off. The thing is, if you come on the Media, it's not just one forum we're offering. It's a package. NPR has lots of shows. Let me ask you, do you like Celtic music? Could I dangle the thistle and shamrock in front of you? Yeah, I keep getting cut off. Look, Scott, we can't pay for your trip to New York, but we can entertain the hell out of you once you're here. Have you seen the Lower East Side Tenement Museum? It totally rocks. And how about USS Intrepid? It's like a boat. Scott? Scott? Do you need a tote bag? Scott?
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price, Katya Rogers, Megan Ryan, Tony Field, and Sean Landis, engineered by Dylan Keefe and Rob Christensen, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Sharon Ball, Blake Carlton, and Josh Keating. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer, and Dean Capello our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Support for On the Media comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John D. and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.